Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and that is the Korean K-pop sensation BTS singing their summer hit Permission to Dance at the United Nations General Assembly in New York City yesterday. The seven-member band opened the United Nations General Assembly with speeches on the importance of learning about climate change and promoting vaccination against COVID-19 before they danced their way through the UN headquarters premises. The performance drew more than a million viewers on YouTube alone. By the way, the Washington Post reports that that number usually only hovers around 50,000 for events like that. Just this morning, President Joe Biden took to the podium in the uncomfortable atmosphere created by the United States' messy withdrawal from Afghanistan and a nuclear submarine pact that angered a certain European ally that may or may not be named France. Joining me now to discuss the latest and hear an excerpt or two from Joe Biden's speech that just took place is Ishan Tharoor, Washington Post columnist on international affairs and author of Today's Worldview, the Post's international affairs newsletter. Hi, Ishan. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for having me back.
And by way of background, before we hear what the president said at the General Assembly, for your Today's Worldview newsletter this morning, you wrote this was not the atmosphere Biden wanted ahead of delivering his first speech at the United Nations as president. And there is, of course, what critics are calling the botched exit in Afghanistan. So let's tackle that first. We've been covering what critics at home are saying. What has been the global response?
Right. Well, of course, the global response, there's no united one, but among the U.S.'s longstanding allies in Europe, there were two levels of frustration. First, that they did not want the Biden administration, at least some of these governments in Europe, though they recognized that there was a need to draw this war down, they did not want the Biden administration to stick to the timelines that had first been set in place by the Trump administration before, which was this relatively quick withdrawal this year. And then on a deeper level, they felt very frustrated with the lack of genuine consultation with the United States, especially the NATO countries. This is the war in Afghanistan is NATO's only real mission that's ever happened. And it was for a lot of these European countries to see the collapse of the Afghan government, the way in which the Taliban took power so quickly and so steadily. It was for them a pretty significant blow of their prestige and their sense of, you know, in the wake of the Cold War, the first major military missions that a lot of these countries involved in NATO participated in was this operation in Afghanistan. And so there's a lot of hand-wringing. I think at the same time, they all recognize that without the United States, they're not going to go about doing anything different in a country so far away and so distant from their national interests as Afghanistan. And then, of course, as you pointed to, the other major irritant that has emerged in the last month is this spat with France over a nuclear submarine arrangement that the U.S. forged essentially behind France's back alongside the British and the Australians.
How'd that happen?
It's interesting. You know, this is something clearly that the U.S. Has had in mind for some time. They wanted to boost and bolster the Australian Navy with these nuclear-powered submarines. And this was an arrangement that is quite unique in the sense that they're sharing technology with the Australians that they've only ever shared with the British in manning these submarines. But, of course, the Australians had to, at the same time, essentially scrap this agreement with France that they had inked a few years ago. A mega arrangement, it was initially $50 billion. It kind of overran costs to around $90 billion in a deal with the French and French company to build these submarines in Australia. And the French are furious. They have initiated a diplomatic kind of spat with Americans that they never, sort of the likes we never saw under the Trump administration. And we imagined that time as a much more kind of combustive moment in transatlantic relations. But they've withdrawn the ambassador. They're now wheeling around and trying to essentially stop altogether ongoing trade talks between the Europe and Australia. And then at the same time, they're going to be pretty skeptical of the Biden agenda going forward. And there are murmurs that the French will not participate in Biden's upcoming summit of democracies.
So much of the coverage that I hear of this says France is mostly angry, angry because they weren't told about it in advance. Do you think if Biden had called up the president of France and said, hey, Macron, I hate to do this, but look, we really have to beef up Australia's nuclear submarine capacity as a defense against Chinese expansionism. So I hope you understand we've got to do this. Would that have headed off this diplomatic fury?
It's complicated. There's what we understand is that the Biden administration did tell the French just a couple of days in advance, and that all things considered was quite late. The French also believe that the U.S. administration had essentially lied to them over the past few months by not talking about these talks while they were having these talks. So there is a degree of genuine trust that has been broken. On top, I think, but as you've kind of alluding to, there are other considerations that the French have. French President Emmanuel Macron is entering a presidential election cycle and is being hammered already both from the left and the right about the kind of faith he has placed in the American alliance. And so this is so he does have to kind of show a bit of defiance now. And this is going to fit into the longstanding and specifically French vision of Europe's strategic autonomy. And so now you're going to have a pretty involved European discussion about the way forward and the ways in which Europe needs to protect itself and perhaps keep the U.S. at arm's length in certain ways. But there are many other European countries that want the French to get over this and recognize that this is in nobody's real interest to have this lingering dispute.
So President Biden just concluded his first speech as president before the UN General Assembly. This happens every year at this time. We're going to play a one-minute clip here in which he discusses how the U.S. is turning away from the Middle East, broadly defined to include Afghanistan, and refocusing on the Indo-Pacific.
We've ended 20 years of conflict in Afghanistan. And as we close this period of relentless war, we're opening a new era of relentless diplomacy, of using the power of our development aid to invest in new ways of lifting people up around the world, of renewing and defending democracy, of proving that no matter how challenging or how complex the problems we're going to face, government by and for the people is still the best way to deliver for all of our people. And as the United States turns our focus to the priorities and the regions of the world, like the Indo-Pacific, that are most consequential today and tomorrow, we'll do so with our allies and partners through cooperation in multilateral institutions like the United Nations to amplify our collective strength and speed our progress toward dealing with these global challenges.
So that was one clip. I'm going to go right on to another, in which Biden focuses on climate change. He spent a fair amount of his address talking about climate change. So let's listen to his call for all nations to bring more to the table.
And the scientists and experts are telling us that we're fast approaching a point of no return in a literal sense. To keep within our reach the vital goal of limiting global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, every nation needs to bring their highest possible ambitions to the table when we meet in Glasgow for COP26. And then to have to keep raising our collective ambition over time.
President Biden from his speech at the UN General Assembly this morning. We'll play another clip in a couple of minutes where he talks about the pandemic. Our guest is Ishan Tharoor, who covers foreign affairs for The Washington Post and their newsletter. Ishan, what stood out to you in terms of Biden's approach to climate? Anything we haven't heard before?
Not particularly. These are the two major planks of his agenda right now, especially in the coming weeks. Setting the stage for this major UN climate summit in Glasgow at the beginning of November, where Biden, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and other world leaders are really hoping governments from everywhere come and make major commitments to scale back emissions. So they're building up the momentum for that. And then, as we will probably go on to discuss later, he is now after really flooding his own country with vaccines, is trying to shoulder the kind of global burden in helping the rest of the world get vaccinated. He's set this pretty ambitious goal of getting 70% of the world's population vaccinated by this time next year. And that will require considerable both major donations on the part of wealthy countries, but also activists have been calling for this for quite some time, certain concessions from these major pharmaceutical companies to allow intellectual property waivers to happen, to allow poorer nations to develop versions of their vaccines themselves. So this is a slightly complicated political challenge, but he's also piling ahead with that. It was a pretty interesting speech insofar as it really, you heard him try to gloss over the major kind of foreign policy stumbling blocks of the last few weeks. He has a compelling pitch on a certain level. He recognizes that the war in Afghanistan needed to end. It was a 20-year American commitment that for many years American officials recognized wasn't going anywhere. Then by speaking very broadly to the Indo-Pacific, he is signaling America's interest both in pivoting to Asia, as is the phrase that we've come to deploy constantly now, and recognizing that the main arena of strategic confrontation is nowhere near Europe for the U.S., but it is in Asia, and it is obviously recognized in the face of the rise of China.
Listeners, we can take a few phone calls for Ishan Tharoor from The Washington Post. Anybody listening right now who watched or heard Biden's speech this morning before the General Assembly, before you turned on the show, or if you want to talk about the U.S. and the world generally right now, or the U.N. General Assembly generally right now. We're going to have an interesting guest later in the week from Rwanda, by the way. But the focus right now with Biden speaking on this day one of head of state speeches, usually Brazil goes first and then the host country, which of course is the U.S. because the U.N. is located here, goes second. And that's what happened this morning. 646-435-7280 with comments or questions. 646-435-7280 or a tweet at Brian Lehrer. Let me come back to climate for a minute. Then we'll pivot back to the pandemic and vaccinations. But I don't want to give climate short shrift at all here. How much has this year's UN General Assembly so far been focused on climate change compared to years before, after the intense weather summer that we've had in the U.S. and elsewhere around the world, or maybe even it was planned before that?
Well, I think the talk shop often sounds quite the same year into year, especially UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. He's kind of a bit of a broken record now in the ways in which he is compelled to constantly warn the world that now is the time and we're reaching a point of no return and we have to make commitments now. And especially during the Trump years, climate change was a major part of the conversation, except that the United States wasn't part of that conversation. The United States was actively undermining that conversation. And the one thing the Biden administration has very clearly done, and perhaps one of the main ways in which it has, given its allies elsewhere cause to celebrate, is that it is, trying to reassert American leadership in the climate space. He had this major climate conference hosted virtually by the U.S. earlier this year, where they outlined initial commitments. And this administration, the climate envoy John Kerry, they are quite active right now in terms of figuring out how to meet some of these very aggressive deadlines that scientists are putting forward in terms of having to make certain cuts in order to prevent a rise above 1.5 degrees Celsius. And we have a very limited time frame. Biden said this is the decade that's going to shape the future of our planet. And so they are quite hell-bent on doing that. I think part of that is going to require very tricky diplomacy with the new emerging major emitters, you know, China, India, and so forth, who for a very long time have, you could say justifiably, said, look, the industrial nations are the ones that pumped most of the stuff into the atmosphere. We cannot make the same concessions without, you know, while we're still industrializing. But obviously that isn't really an option the world has at this moment. And so the Biden administration and many other wealthy developed powers are now figuring out what a major new global compact can look like that gets India and China on board.
Yeah. Well, what about that? Because this is the General Assembly. You remind us in your reporting that just 6 weeks from now, there'll be a major UN climate conference per se in Glasgow. So will their goal to just be to stay on the Paris Climate Agreement targets that exist or move those targets?
No, I think everyone's recognized that the Paris climate targets are insufficient. The U.S. and a number of other countries have made pretty ambitious calls to fully decarbonize in the next couple of decades or cut emissions to a certainly significant amount by the next decade. And then we'll have to see what happens going forward. There's a lot of focus on coal and whether more governments can commit to phasing out the use of coal in a more rapid time frame. And of course, for the Biden administration, part of galvanizing political momentum around this is a major domestic push to convince the U.S. public that this is also in the economic interest of the United States, that part of the U.S. leading the way around the world when it comes to really pressing ahead with climate action is that the U.S. wants to be able to set the rules for new technologies. It wants to have its businesses be on the cutting edge of the green technology in the green technology space, and this is part of a new kind of zone for competition in the decades to come.
He talked about the COVAX initiative. That's the global initiative to get 70% of the world vaccinated against COVID-19 in the next year. So let's take a listen to him touting the U.S.'s achievements so far.
Already, the United States has put more than $15 billion toward the global COVID response. We've shipped more than 160 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine to other countries. This includes 130 million doses from our own supply and the first tranches of the 500 million doses of Pfizer vaccine we purchased to donate through COVAX.
So critics, Ishan, as you report, are saying the Biden administration can do much more than he was touting there to ease intellectual property protections, for example, to make vaccinations more available around the world. What are they asking for?
Well, it is a bit of a tricky conundrum, and it kind of makes its way to the WTO, the World Trade Organization, where a body that has the ability to waive certain property protections. It hasn't happened yet. There's also a political issue with the United States and Europe, where a number of European governments, especially that of German Chancellor Angela Merkel's, do not want to do this waiving of international property protections on the Pfizer vaccine, for example. There's a whole other issue of supply chains and the ways in which the pandemic, as well as export bans in various countries, has kind of stymied the ability of COVAX to funnel vaccines to the most neglected parts of the world, especially in sub-Saharan Africa, where even now, only a fraction of frontline medical workers, let alone the general population, have been able to get the vaccine. There's no single answer. I think the critics really were sounding the alarm almost a year ago when maybe around the time Biden came to power, when it was very clear that the U.S. was going full steam ahead in terms of amassing a stockpile of supply to vaccinate its own population, but was not doing very much and in some ways was inhibiting the capacity for poorer nations to receive vaccines or produce their own. Now, after the U.S. has not only vaccinated as many people as, you know, who want to get vaccinated, but also presided over the astonishing waste of hundreds of thousands of doses in various states across the country. It's donating excess supply now. It's now trying to lead efforts to speed vaccinations elsewhere. But this comes amid a year of activism and pressure. So what the Biden administration is now trying to do and trying to harness is good and important, but the activists will tell you that this should have happened much, much earlier.
James in the Bronx has a question about the U.S.-Australia submarine deal, that is nuclear-powered submarine sales from U.S. to Australia that has so angered France, cutting out their old contract to provide submarines to Australia or sell them. James, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi there. Thank you for taking my call. Yes, my comment comes because I think that Paris is being a little bit intellectually dishonest when it comes to their anger over the deal. The comments that this was a strategic backstab, I think, are a little overblown, because what I think is important to remember is that Emmanuel Macron was an official in the previous administration when he inked this deal. And so it blowing up in his face this close to elections is just sort of a matter of losing face. But it also doesn't seem to me that Paris is recognizing as readily as they should that nuclear-powered submarines simply operate with larger range than diesel-powered submarines do. And if we're going to make Australia a significant strategic partner in the Indo-Pacific, they need to be able to operate in a capacity that gets them beyond the equator and into the South China Sea.
James, thank you very much. I'm going to leave it there for time. Give me just a quick 15-second response to that, Ishan, and then I want to ask you a closing question.
Well, yes, they're right, but the French would counter that the Australians could have purchased nuclear submarines from France but didn't want to at the time.
So last thing, not to bury the lead, maybe we did, you were live tweeting Biden's speech, and you wrote, "Biden is delivering a speech that is an obvious rejection of America first, rooted in a kind of global empathy, respect for common struggles, liberal principles, multilateral cooperation, though all governments are keenly aware of the gap between U.S. rhetoric and action." So there's the gap, but there's also, in our last 30 seconds, the fact that he's not Donald Trump.
Oh, and this was, you know, proudly on display during the speech. And for anyone who's listened to it, it was, you know, if you remember the last 4 years, Trump has come to the UN almost as a kind of enemy combatant, and you know, there were incidents where he was laughed at in the General Assembly. Biden was not laughed at here. He was, you know, he said things that were really sort of appeals to him, a certain kind of rhetorical liberalism. He talked about how we, the U.S., benefits when others succeed, which is kind of the polar opposite of Trumpism, right. And really set his stall out in a really idealistic way. He said he appealed to universal principles. He talked about how the democratic world is everywhere, which was an astonishingly idealistic thing to say. And so this was the speech he probably wanted to give without the hiccups of the last few weeks.
Listeners, you should read Ishan Tharoor's really excellent foreign affairs column and his email newsletter from the Washington Post. Thank you so much for coming on with us and breaking down Biden's speech.
Always a pleasure to be with you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.